Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something, well, pretty mind-bending.
Yeah.
We're tracing this amazing thread connecting, of all things, Bach, the composer.
Right.
M.C. Escher, the artist known for those impossible drawings.
Yeah, the visual paradoxes.
And Kurt Gödel, the logician who, well, basically showed us the limits of logic itself. It's this incredibly intricate web.
It really is. And that thread, we call it the eternal golden braid. Our goal today is to sort of pull out the core ideas. We're talking self-reference, limits and formal systems, how meaning emerges.
And hopefully give you those aha moments.
Exactly. Those moments where you see the fundamental tangles in, well, everything from music to math to our own minds. It's about the nature of knowledge.
And the big idea holding it all together, you said, is the strange loop.
The strange loop. Or you might hear it called a tangled hierarchy. It's this idea that when you move up or down levels in a system like, think of layers of meaning or abstraction, you suddenly find yourself right back where you started.
Huh. So not just a circle, but like a staircase that loops back.
Precisely. It's a hierarchy where the top level somehow depends on or influences the bottom level. It becomes cyclically defined. And understanding this loop, well, it's key to understanding why formal systems hit a wall, and maybe even why we feel conscious.
Okay, that's a big claim. Let's dive in. Where do we start this journey? Music.
Let's start with Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach, and a very specific piece, the musical offering.
Ah, the story behind this one is fantastic, isn't it? It involves royalty.
It does. Bach visits King Frederick the Great of Prussia in 1747. The king, who was quite musical himself, gives Bach this really complex, maybe even a bit dry theme, the royal theme.
And challenges him on the spot.
Demands, really, that Bach improvise a six-voice fugue based on it right then and there.
Which is basically impossible.
Pretty much superhuman, yeah. Bach couldn't quite manage six voices off the cuff, but he promised the king he'd work it out, compose it properly, and send it to him.
And the result was the musical offering. But why is it so central to this idea of strange loops?
Because within it, Bach plays these incredible games with musical copies, with preserving information. The technical term is isomorphism.
Isomorphism. Okay, break that down.
It just means an information-preserving transformation. You can twist something around, flip it, play it backwards. But if it's an isomorphism, all the original information is still there. You can get back to the start. The structure is identical, just presented differently.
Like a mirror image contained all the info of the original.
Exactly. And Bach uses this brilliantly in the canons within the musical offering. The most stunning example has to be the crab canon.
The crab canon. Why crab? Because they walk sideways.
Kind of. It's because it moves forwards and backwards at the same time. Imagine one musical line, one voice playing the main theme.
Okay.
Now imagine a second voice starting at the exact same time, playing the exact same theme, but starting from the very last note and going backward to the first.
Whoa, seriously?
Seriously. They play simultaneously, one forwards, one backwards, and they meet perfectly in the middle, then continue until they end together, having swapped places.
So it's like a musical palindrome unfolding in time.
That's a perfect way to put it. The retrograde motion playing it backward preserves all the melody, all the rhythm. It's a closed loop. Pure structure, pure logic, but expressed in sound. It refers only to itself.
That sounds incredibly rigid, though. Almost mathematical.
It is. The canons are very strict. But that's contrasted beautifully with the fugues in the same work. Fugues have rules too, a theme, a counter subject, but Bach gives them so much more freedom, more, you know, artistry.
So it's not just formula.
Definitely not. If it were just formula, it would sound mechanical. Bach shows how the structure can support the genius, not constrain it. You get this tension between the strict self-reference of the canon and the expressive freedom of the fugue. That's kind of the braid in miniature.
Okay, from Bach's temporal loops in music. Let's jump forward a couple of centuries to M.C. Escher. He made these loops visual.
He really did. If Bach played with time, Escher played with levels, with hierarchy. He drew things that look plausible at first glance, but logically can't exist in our normal 3D space because the levels get tangled.
The classic example everyone knows must be drawing hands.
Drawing hands is the perfect, most direct visual strange loop. You've got two hands, each one is drawing the other.
Right. Hand A draws hand B, but hand B is drawing hand A.
Exactly. So which one is real? Which one is the drawing? The hierarchy creator and created just folds in on itself. There's no outside perspective, no absolute level. They define each other. It's a two-step loop.
And sometimes he made the loop even tighter, almost dizzying, like in print gallery.
Oh, print gallery is maybe the tightest loop he ever did.
Yeah.
You see a young man looking at a print in a gallery. You follow his gaze into the print, and the print depicts the town the gallery's in, and then the gallery itself, and then the young man looking at the print.
So the picture contains itself.
Contains itself, yeah. Or at least it spirals infinitely inwards,
Right.
suggesting self-containment. It's that same idea of a hierarchy collapsing inwards, creating this impossible self-referential space.
Now, those famous impossible staircases and waterfalls he drew, ascending and descending, waterfall, those weren't entirely his original illusion, were they?
That's right. The specific geometric trick for those was actually figured out by Roger Penrose, the physicist. But Escher had already been exploring the spirit of the strange loop for years before that. Penrose gave him a new tool, but the fascination with levels, with loops, with things turning back on themselves, that was pure Escher going way back. Drawing Hands is from 1948.
So we have these loops in music and art,
yeah.
But then we get to logic. And for the logicians around the turn of the 20th century, these loops weren't beautiful or fascinating. They were dangerous.
Oh, absolutely terrifying for them. They were trying to build this absolutely solid, contradiction-proof foundation for all of mathematics. And these self-referential paradoxes were like landmines constantly blowing up their theories.
The most famous one being the liar paradox.
The classic, this statement is false. Simple, right? But think about it. If it's true, then what it says must be correct, meaning it must be false.
Okay.
But if it's false, then what it says is incorrect, meaning it's not false, which means it must be true.
I don't know. It just breaks logic.
It breaks logic. It shows that language, when it's allowed to talk about its own truth or falsity, can tie itself in knots. It can self-destruct.
And this wasn't just a word game. It had real consequences for mathematics, especially set theory.
Huge consequences. Bertrand Russell stumbled onto a devastating one, Russell's paradox.
Okay, how does that one work? It's about sets, like collections of things.
Exactly. Think about sets. Most sets aren't members of themselves. Like the set of all teacups isn't itself a teacup. It's a concept, a collection.
Makes sense. Those are normal sets.
Russell called them run-of-the-mill sets. Then he asked, what about the set of all run-of-the-mill sets? Let's call this set R.
Okay, R is the set containing all sets that don't contain themselves.
Right. Now for the killer question. Is R, this special set, a member of itself? Is R run-of-the-mill?
Uh-oh. Let's see. If R is a member of itself, then it must be run-of-the-mill, according to its own definition.
But run-of-the-mill means it's not a member of itself, so that leads to a contradiction.
Okay, so it can't be a member of itself.
But if R is not a member of itself, then it is run-of-the-mill.
Which means it should be included in R, the set of all run-of-the-mill sets.
Contradiction again. Either way, you crash. This was huge because it showed that a very basic, seemingly intuitive way of defining sets was fundamentally flawed. It shook the foundations.
So paradoxes showed that self-reference was like logical quicksand. What did they try to do about it? Ban it.
They tried. Russell himself, with Alfred North Whitehead, developed this thing called the theory of types. The basic idea was to stratify language into strict levels.
Levels again?
Yep. Level 0 talks about objects, level 1 talks about statements about objects, level 0, level 2 talks about statements about level 1 statements, and so on. Crucially, a statement could never refer to itself or any statement on its own level or a higher level.
So this statement is false becomes illegal because it refers to itself on its own level.
Exactly. It tried to legislate strange loops out of existence, even indirect ones where, say, statement A points to statement B and statement B points back to statement A.
But that sounds incredibly awkward for, like, normal talking.
Completely impractical. Imagine trying to say, the article I'm writing explains the theory of types. That statement is about the article, which exists on the same level as the statement itself. Forbidden.
Yeah, language would just fall apart.
It proved that strange loops aren't some weird defect. They seem to be a necessary feature of any language or system powerful enough to talk about itself, which includes, you know, human thought.
Which brings us, inevitably, to Kurt Gödel. He didn't just find a paradox. He weaponized the strange loop inside mathematics itself.
He did, and the context was that desperation for certainty we mentioned. David Hilbert, a towering figure in mathematics, launched this hugely ambitious project.
Hilbert's program. What was the goal?
To find a single formal system for all of mathematics that was provably complete and consistent.
Okay, complete and consistent. What do those mean in this context?
Consistent means the system never contradicts itself. You can't prove both a statement and its opposite are true. If a system isn't consistent, it's useless.
Right. No contradictions.
Complete means that every true statement that can be expressed in the system's language is also provable within the system using its rules. Hilbert wanted a system where truth and provability were exactly the same thing. No true but unprovable statements lurking out there.
He wanted a perfect, airtight rulebook for all mathematical truth.
That's the dream. And they tried to build these systems using only finitistic, reasoning, clear mechanical steps a computer could follow. Think of something like typographical number theory, TNT. Mm-hmm. It's a formal language designed just to talk about numbers. It has symbols, 0s for successor plus arrow, rules for making formulas, grammar, and rules for deriving theorems from axioms, inference rules.
Pure symbol manipulation.
Pure syntactical. Hilbert believed you could capture all number theory this way and prove it was both consistent and complete.
And Gödel arrives and just shatters that dream.
Utterly. With two absolutely brilliant connected ideas. The first was Gödel numbering.
The code.
The ultimate code, yes. He figured out a way to assign a unique, massive number to every symbol in a formal system like TNT, every possible string of symbols, formulas, and even every sequence of formulas that formed a valid proof.
How does assigning numbers help?
It creates an isomorphism. It maps the syntax of the formal system onto the arithmetic of numbers. Suddenly, statements about the system like formula X is an axiom or sequence Y is a proof of formula Z could be translated into statements purely about numbers and their properties using things like prime factorization.
Whoa. So the system could use its own language number theory to talk about its own rules and proofs.
Exactly. That's the introspection. TNT, through Gödel numbering, gained the ability to contain statements that referred to other statements within TNT, even statements about provability itself. The metalanguage got encoded inside the object language.
The very thing Russell tried to ban.
The very thing. Gödel deliberately built a mechanism for self-reference right into the heart of formal arithmetic.
Okay, so he built the tool for self-reference. What did he do with it? That brings us to the second idea.
The second idea was to use this tool to construct a very specific self-referential statement. The Gödel sentence, often just called G.
This is where the liar paradox comes back in.
It's inspired by it, but Gödel was incredibly careful. The liar paradox, this statement is false, leads to outright contradiction. Gödel needed something more subtle. He constructed a sentence, G, within the formal system. Let's use TNT as our example system, though he originally did it for the more complex Principia Mathematica, or PM. This sentence, G, effectively says, the statement G is not provable within the system TNT.
Okay. This statement is not provable within this system. Let's walk through this slowly. What happens if we assume TNT is consistent, which Hilbert wanted?
Right. Assume consistency. Now, suppose G was provable in TNT.
If G is provable, then what it says must be true, right? Wait, no. If G is provable, then the statement G is not provable would be false.
Exactly. If G is provable, then TNT has proven a false statement because G itself claims it's not provable. But a system that proves false statements is inconsistent.
So if TNT is consistent, G cannot be provable within TNT.
Correct. We've just logically deduced from outside the system for a moment that G must be unprovable inside the system, assuming the system's consistency.
Okay, G is unprovable within TNT, but what does G itself say?
G says G is not provable within TNT.
Which we just showed is true.
Precisely. G is true. But we also showed it's unprovable within the system.
Wow. So there it is. A statement that is definitely true according to the rules of arithmetic, but which the formal system TNT itself cannot prove using its own axioms and rules of inference.
That is Gödel's first incompleteness theorem. Any formal system powerful enough to express basic arithmetic, if it is consistent, must necessarily be incomplete. There will always be true statements about numbers that the system cannot prove. Hilbert's dream was impossible.
The strange loop strikes again. The system's ability to talk about its own provability creates a statement it cannot handle.
It's the deep irony. PM and similar systems were designed specifically to avoid paradoxes like the liar. Gödel showed how to sneak the structure of that paradox back into the system using arithmetic coding.
You used an analogy earlier, the phonograph.
Ah, yes. It's like designing the perfect phonograph that can play any record. But then someone figures out how to press a record where the groove encodes a sound frequency that perfectly matches the resonant frequency of the phonograph's own stylus assembly.
So when you try to play that record,
the sound it produces literally shakes the stylus so violently it jumps out of the groove. The record makes itself unplayable through its own content.
G is the unplayable record for the formal system.
A beautiful analogy for it, the system's mechanism for producing truth, proof, is vibrated or undermined by a statement constructed using its own encoding capabilities.
And it gets worse, right? He didn't just show systems are incomplete. He showed something about proving consistency, too.
That's Gödel's second incompleteness theorem. It's even more devastating in some ways. He showed that any sufficiently powerful, consistent formal system cannot prove its own consistency from within itself.
Wait, so TNT cannot prove TNT is consistent?
Correct. If TNT could prove its own consistency, that proof could be used, in a roundabout way related back to G, to actually prove G itself. But we already know G is unprovable if TNT is consistent. So the consistency of TNT must also be unprovable within TNT.
So you need a stronger outside system to prove the consistency of a weaker system. But then that stronger system's consistency is unprovable within it. It turtles all the way down.
It is an infinite regress. You can never reach a final self-validating foundation using purely formal methods. The search for absolute certainty through formalism hit an unbreachable wall, defined by the inescapable nature of self-reference.
Okay, that's the limit of proof. This feels like a good place to shift from pure logic to something maybe even slipperier, meaning where does meaning actually come from?
That's a great transition. We've seen information can be encoded, Bach, transformed, Escher, and even used to talk about its own limits, Gödel. But what makes a sequence of symbols or patterns actually mean something? Is the meaning in the message the information bearer? Or is it created by whatever interprets it, the information revealer?
Let's use the record player example again. The vinyl record is the bearer.
Right. It bears the grooves, the physical pattern. The record player is the revealer. Its needle and amplifier mechanism reveal the sound that was encoded in those grooves. Here, the meaning seems largely inherent in the bearer, just needing the right mechanism to unlock it.
But you mentioned the jukebox earlier.
Mm-hmm.
How is that different?
Well, think about a classic jukebox. You punch in, say, E5.
Mm-hmm.
That sequence E5 doesn't encode the song you want to hear. It's just a trigger.
I see. The song is already stored inside the jukebox.
Exactly. The jukebox mechanism supplies the meaning, the song, based on the simple trigger you provided. The meaning isn't really in the trigger E5. It's entirely dependent on the internal context of the machine.
Okay, bearer versus trigger. How does this apply to biology, to DNA? That seems like the ultimate information bearer.
It does. The DNA molecule, the genotype, clearly contains information that specifies the organism, the phenotype. But is it like the record bearer or the jukebox button trigger?
Where do you land on that?
It's much closer to being a set of incredibly complex triggers. The DNA sequence itself, the A's, T's, C's, and G's, it doesn't contain the full instructions in isolation.
It needs the rest of the cell.
It absolutely needs the enormously complex machinery of the cell. The enzymes, the ribosomes, the folding environment, the chemical gradients, these are like the biojukebox. They interpret the DNA sequence, but they themselves aren't explicitly coded for in that sequence in the same simple way. The meaning emerges from the interaction between the DNA triggers and the cellular context.
So if we sent just a strand of DNA out into space, an alien civilization might not be able to reconstruct the organism just from the sequence.
Very likely not, unless they could somehow reconstruct the entire cellular environment and its chemical rules. This gets to the idea of universality in messages.
What makes a message truly universal, then? Something that could be understood anywhere by any intelligence?
The idea is that a message might be universal only if it possesses enough compelling inner logic that its context will be restored automatically whenever intelligence of a high enough level comes in contact with it.
So not just random noise. It has to have deep structure, like dog's music, maybe, or mathematical truths.
Possibly. A sequence that shows complex, non-random patterns, internal consistency, maybe even hints of the rules needed to decode it, that suggests intelligence and invites interpretation. But it's a very high bar. Even Bach, is the emotion we feel universal, or is it tied to human biology and culture? Probably the latter.
What would even make an alien suspect that a long molecule like DNA or a spiral disk is a message?
That's the role of the frame message. It's the signal that says, hey, look closer. This isn't just random.
What constitutes a frame message?
Two key things, often. One is the overall form, a perfect geometric shape, like a sphere or disk or the regular double helix of DNA, looks unnatural. The second, and maybe more important, is the content. A long, aperiodic sequence.
Aperiodic, meaning non-repeating.
Exactly. Crystals have repeating periodic structures. Natural processes often produce randomness or simple repetition, but a long, complex sequence that doesn't repeat suggests information content. Think of the grooves on a record or the base pairs in DNA, incredibly long, complex, and non-repeating. That screams artificial, or at least information-rich.
This idea of needing context, needing the rules. The Fibonacci sequence is a good example, isn't it?
Perfect example. The sequence goes 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13. You can think of the first pair, 1, 1, as the genotype, the seed.
Okay.
But the entire sequence, the phenotype, only emerges if you have the recursive rule. Each new number is the sum of the previous two. Without that rule, just sending 1, 1 doesn't convey the whole sequence.
The rule is the context, the interpreter, the bio jukebox again.
Precisely. The genotype is insufficient without the recursive algorithm to pull out the phenotype. Meaning requires both the data and the process.
Which leads us back to DNA's most amazing trick, self-replication. This sounds like the ultimate biological strange loop.
It really is. Remember the use-mentioned distinction in language? Mentioning a word is referring to it as an object, like putting it in quotes. Using a word is employing it for its meaning.
Right. How does DNA do both?
Well, DNA acts as a template for copying itself. That's its mention role. It's just being passively duplicated. But it also contains the instructions, the genes that dictate which proteins to build and indirectly how the replication and cellular machinery should operate. That's its use role. It's an active program.
And this happens across multiple levels of meaning.
Absolutely. You have the transcription level, DNA to RNA, the translation level, RNA codons to amino acids, the protein folding level, and then these higher, much less understood levels that influence tissues, organs, even behavior, and maybe psychological traits. It's an incredible hierarchy.
The source called this the central dog map.
Yes, a playful twist on the central dogma of biology. It highlights this unbelievably intricate fusion where the program, genes, the data, the sequence itself, and the interpreter, the cellular machinery, are all intertwined and crucially are all replicated together during cell division.
Unlike our computers, where we clearly separate hardware, software, and data.
Biology just bundles it all up in this complex, self-referential, replicating chemical loop. It's a tangled hierarchy of breathtaking complexity.
Which finally brings us to the human mind, AI, and cognition. How do these ideas of levels, loops, and self-reference play out in thought itself?
Well, our minds constantly use levels of description to manage complexity. We chunk information. Think about chess players again.
The grandmasters don't see individual pieces, they see patterns.
Exactly. They operate on a higher level of abstraction, developing the queen side, pawn structure weakness. They chunk the board into meaningful strategic units. That's why they can recall game positions so well.
But only if the positions make sense strategically, right? If it's random, they're no better than beginners.
Precisely. Because the random board has no high-level chunks they can recognize. Their expertise vanishes. This chunking happens everywhere. Computer science has its levels two machine code at the bottom, then assembly, then high-level languages like Python.
And problems arise when these levels don't communicate well.
For sure. If your Python program crashes, the computer might just give you a cryptic machine code error address. That's the lowest level reality. But you need the high-level explanation. You tried to divide by zero in the calculate average function. Translating meaning accurately between these levels is a huge challenge, both in computers and in understanding the brain.
So in the brain, these high-level chunks, these concepts, we can think of them as active symbols.
That's a useful way to think about it. Active subsystems in the brain correspond to concepts or symbols. We need to distinguish, though.
Between
class symbols, the general concept, like the abstract idea of dog or book and instance symbols, the incredibly rich specific neural pattern representing the specific dog, Fido, barking right now, or that particular book, worn cover, familiar smell, our brain seamlessly blends these.
But unlike computer memory, you can't just point to one spot in the brain and say, there's the dog symbol.
Well, almost certainly not. And this is where the hierarchy gets really tangled in the brain. Symbols aren't likely neat little boxes. They're probably overlapping and distributed. A single neuron might participate in representing hundreds or thousands of different symbols, both class and instance types.
So you can't physically separate the levels or the symbols?
It seems unlikely. The lowest physical level, neurons, synapses, is inextricably interwoven with the highest conceptual level, thoughts, ideas, symbols. Any attempt to neatly divide the brain into functionally distinct subsystems seems doomed to fail because of this intense interconnectedness. It's tangled all the way down.
This physical tangling sounds like it has major implications for artificial intelligence, especially when we think about the classic Turing test.
Absolutely. Alan Turing's test, can a machine fool a human into thinking it's also human through conversation, set the bar. While AI is amazing at specific tasks, that general, flexible, human-like intelligence is still elusive. And Gödel's ghost looms large here, particularly via the Lucas argument.
Or the argument that uses Gödel's theorem to say humans can't be machines. How does it work?
Philosopher J.R. Lucas argued, suppose you build an AI, a machine, that perfectly models a human mind. That machine, being computational, must be equivalent to a formal system.
Okay, like TNT.
Right, but if it's a formal system, then Gödel's theorem applies. We humans, standing outside the system, can understand the machine's programming, find its Gödel sentence G, the statement is unprovable by this machine. We can see that G is true, even though the machine cannot prove it.
So we can always perform a logical step the machine cannot. We can out-Gödel it.
That's the claim. Therefore, Lucas argued, no machine can ever fully replicate the human mind because we always have this ability to transcend the system. Our minds are not formal systems.
It sounds elegant, but is it right? Is the human mind truly unlimited in that way?
Well, the counterargument is powerful. Are we really outside the system? We are also physical beings operating according to physical laws. Our brains are finite. We also have limits.
So maybe we just can't see our own limits.
Perhaps. We might eventually hit a complexity ceiling where we can no longer reliably find the Gödel sentence for incredibly complex systems, maybe even including our own brains. The key idea here is that the mind isn't a neat formal system, but a tangled hierarchy.
Meaning the levels are mixed up?
Critically, the lowest physical level, the neurons, the biochemistry, is largely inviolate, meaning our conscious symbolic level can't fully access or manipulate it directly. We can't consciously decide which neuron should fire.
So we operate on the high symbolic level, and because we can't see the underlying machinery perfectly, we get the illusion of being able to step outside any system.
That's the argument. It feels like transcendence, like we're not bound by rules, because the ultimate rule-bound physical level is hidden from our own symbolic self-model. It reminds me of Zen koans trying to break free from perceived limitations. Perhaps that's really about escaping the self-imposed constraints of our high-level symbolic processing, not escaping physical law.
This tangle, this mix of self-awareness at the high level and ignorance of the low level,
yeah.
Does this connect to the feeling of free will?
It seems deeply connected. Think about making a decision. Your concept of self, your self-symbol, a high-level construct, interacts with incoming data and other concepts.
Okay.
This interaction, this swirling vortex of high-level symbols, is the process of deliberation. Because your self-symbol is part of the calculation, it feels like you are driving the process.
It creates the Gödel vortex you mentioned.
Yes, the levels cross.
Yeah.
Down at the electrochemical level, it's presumably deterministic physics, or maybe quantum randomness, but still not free in the spooky sense. But your conscious experience is purely at the symbolic level, where you lack the capacity to track every single neuron.
So free will is the subjective experience of navigating the symbolic level while being necessarily ignorant of the underlying deterministic machinery.
That's a compelling way to frame it. It's this balance between self-knowledge, our awareness of our thoughts, goals, the symbolic interplay, and self-ignorance, our inability to monitor the micro details of the physical brain processes. The feeling of choice emerges from that gap.
Like an artist creating something. They know what they want to express, but the how often feels like it comes from somewhere deeper, unseen.
Exactly. The artist relies on this huge iceberg of subconscious processing, associations, memories, source material that's deep underwater. They interact with it at the conscious level, making choices, but they can't map the entire submerged structure. That blend of conscious direction and subconscious emergence feels like creativity. And like freedom.
What an intricate picture. From box cannons to Gödel's limits to the feeling of being me, it all seems to weave together.
That's the eternal golden braid. You have Bach exploring profound structure and self-reference through musical counterpoint.
You have Escher giving us these stunning visual paradoxes of levels folding back on themselves.
And you have Gödel demonstrating with inescapable logic that any system powerful enough to be interesting, like mathematics or perhaps even mind, contains its own inherent limits precisely because of its capacity for self-reference.
So the big takeaway isn't about finding one ultimate foundation or level.
Not at all. It's that intelligence, meaning consciousness itself, they don't live on a single level. They emerge from the incredibly complex, looping, interwoven, self-referential dance between the levels. The tangled hierarchy isn't a flaw, it's the essence.
And connecting this back to Bach and Escher, maybe our sense of what's true isn't just about cold, hard logic either.
I think that's a crucial final thought. When mathematicians or scientists evaluate a proof or a theory, it's not just about logical validity. There's a powerful aesthetic component.
You mean like, is it elegant?
Yeah.
Simple. Beautiful.
Well, exactly. A proof that is logically correct but incredibly convoluted, ugly, or complex often feels less convincing. We intuitively seek beauty and simplicity as indicators of deeper truth. Think of Eamsty, its power lies partly in its incredible compression and elegance.
So intuition, aesthetics, they're not just fuzzy extras, but maybe necessary parts of how high-level thinking works, guiding us through the complexity.
It really suggests they are. They might be essential heuristics, ways our tangled minds navigate vast logical spaces. And perhaps, just perhaps, if we ever build truly general AI, it won't just wrestle with logic and data. It too might find itself running up against the profound problems of art, beauty, simplicity, and maybe even its own Google sentences, proving that this golden braid is woven into the very fabric of intelligence itself.